Compliance is a profession where people work tirelessly to make the world a better place. And there are hundreds of amazing and inspiring women who have helped the field develop into what it is today. Great Women in Compliance is part of the Compliance Podcast Network, so join Mary Shirley and Lisa Fine as they talk with women in compliance who are making a difference.
Hi, you're listening to Great Women in Compliance on the Compliance Podcast Network with Mary Shirley and Lisa Fine. I'm Lisa Fine, and today I'm speaking with Matt Kelly, who needs no introduction for many of you. Matt is the editor and CEO of Radical Compliance, and in his own words, is a longtime writer for and observer of the compliance and GRC world. And in the words of Tom Fox, he is the coolest guy in compliance. And in my words, and the reason why I'm so pleased to have him on the podcast, is that he has really been an advocate and sponsor for women in compliance. Matt was one of the first people to help us start the podcast, and he even spent a day with Mary and I helping us understand the basics of how to do a podcast and providing us feedback and support. That continues till today. Matt and I regularly discuss a lot of different compliance topics. He's always happy to lend an ear. And there were a couple that I've been thinking about lately, and I was so pleased that he would provide his perspective on these for the podcast. And for starters, not only is he not a woman, he is not a lawyer, he's not an auditor, an accountant, and he's not a compliance officer. Matt's a journalist, and he joined the compliance community. So I wanted you to start, first of all, with how did you become the observer of the compliance and GRC world, and what made you want to stay?
Yeah, sure, Lisa. Thanks for having me on. It's really great to be here. I'm glad to see that this podcast has become what it has become. So I started writing about corporate compliance probably around 2003. I've always been a newspaper reporter and journalist, and I still consider myself that first and foremost. But in the early 2000s, had been writing a lot about business and technology, and through a mutual acquaintance in Boston, I met the founders of Compliance Week, and they had just started it. And this would have been when Sarbanes-Oxley had just been passed a couple of months before. And companies were first starting to confront how we actually comply with this. And so the two founders of Compliance Week had been looking for somebody who could write about all this. And they said, can you do it? And I said, well, I don't know. Can your checks clear the bank? And they said, yes. I said, oh, yeah, sure. I can write about compliance. What can go wrong? And, you know, it's been great since then. I wound up running Compliance Week for 10 years and then running Radical Compliance since the start of 2016. And I really love this stuff, these issues that compliance professionals deal with, because it cuts across so many interesting challenges. I think this is endlessly fascinating. And you know, it's a little bit about organizational design and behavior. It's a little bit about shrewd strategic thinking and business sense. It's a little bit about politics and regulatory compliance. And it's a little bit about cool technology to get things done. And it's really about how you would guide large groups of people to do anything. And anybody who's been a leader of more than about three people knows that getting any group of people to do anything is really hard, let alone the sort of challenges compliance officers deal with every day. So like you said, and I'll tell anybody, I think this stuff is fascinating. I have no interest in writing about anything else. So for better or worse, I think this community has stuck with me until I retire, which will be many years from now.
Well, I think on behalf of the community, I think that that's fantastic. I feel very fortunate that you have become one of my sponsors and advisors in the compliance world, and also somebody with whom I speak about these topics. And also we've spoken recently at SCCE and we'll do so again. And there are a couple things that we've been talking about a lot that I think you have great perspective. And the first is about the social justice movement in general, mm-hmm. and also about how Me Too and women and the women's issues and that has influenced what's happening today.
Yeah. I think that the Me Too movement has shaped the social justice movement probably in two big ways, substantive and I guess I would say and tactical. So here's what I mean. I think first on the substantive side, like the Me Too movement demonstrated to most men and probably really to all men that some men are total creeps And I read the details of what Harvey Weinstein did to women who worked for him. I was grossed out. I was disgusted. And I do believe that most men don't behave like him, although I also believe that too many men still behave in more, I'll call them minorly offensive ways, such as calling women honey or discussing which women have the best rear end in the company or all this nonsense that goes on. And the Me Too movement was really an education for men about how much they still have to do to understand the perspective of women in the workforce. Along the same lines, I think the social justice movement has somewhat been an education for white people about how far we have to go to understand the perspective of minorities in the workforce and in public life. I don't think that many people are really inherently evil the way that Harvey Weinstein was abusive and predatory, or the way that I'm sure some very racist people still are in the workforce. I don't think most people are like that. I think a lot of people are occasionally clueless, and on rare occasions can be really clueless, and we need to be aware of it. And that's all about getting to understand how the other recipients of your cluelessness experience that. And that's what the Me Too movement did in gender dynamics. And I think now this is what the social justice movement is starting to do for racial dynamics. And that's a good thing, as weird and awkward and uncomfortable as some of these discussions may be. But that's how I think that Me Too and social justice movements are alike. The other point I had wanted to raise was I said also that I think that tactically what happened with the Me Too movement, I was fascinated by this, is that really it came to its own because of social media. And you see Me Too and social justice protests have used social media to organize people in favor of their causes. I've given a lot of thought about this, as people listening might already be starting to understand. I would say it this way. All organizations have multiple stakeholder groups. You know, you have employees, you have customers, you have investors and business partners and third parties and so on. Within each of those groups, some portion of people, and perhaps even most people within that group, they're sympathetic to the cause. And social media allows those people who are sympathetic to forge alliances across the stakeholder group. So people passionate about the issue, whether it's Me Too or social justice or frankly anything else, but you know, once they start forming alliances on social media, they can kind of encircle the organization. That's been true with Me Too and social justice. It's really true, like I said, of any issue. And I think that's the point I would encourage compliance professionals to think about, and think about it a lot. Social media can allow people of like-minded views to form these alliances across your stakeholder group. And then that alliance can try to hold your company accountable to their own standards of conduct, which might not be yours, might not be what the CEO says, might not even be what regulators say companies must do. It could be some higher standard. But that ability to get different pockets of supporters across all your stakeholders unified and whipped around, like that's new. I don't know that without social media, I don't know that Me Too would have lit up like it did. I don't know that the social justice protests would have lit up like they did, but they have. And that's the sort of thing that I think about a lot, you know, what these things have alike and what they mean for the future.
Yeah. And one thing that's made me think about that's interesting as a similarity and a difference in Me Too, I think a lot of it was joining of like-minded individuals, same with social justice and particularly Black Lives Matter. But with Black Lives Matter, you were also having people videotaping through phones, bad actors, bad acts for the same time. So in a way, certain things just became so crystal clear and so evident that people couldn't kind of step away from it. Maybe similar to some of the text messages or other things through Me Too, but there was a lot of firsthand witnessing initially of some of the real, you know, horrific violence. You know, and I think that was also a way of bringing people together to say, these are real problems. These are, for those who didn't already know that or think that, it really put it in, you know, for all the things that social media may do in a problematic way, in some other ways, this forced people, and I mean a lot of people who are white like me, to really recognize, you know, what what is happening every day and how can we really get involved and do better. And you can't really, you know, sort of think about it. One has to act. And I think that is one thing that I think is a little similar and different, because in Me Too, it was a lot of really bad witness testimony, which I think brings me to this other point that you have talked about before, is about, you know, women making allegations of harassment from a compliance standpoint. Mm-hmm. And these were not with obviously videos that can be circulated through social media or other things, but allegations. And what do we learn with that? And what was happening with Me Too?
Well, I have some thoughts about allegations that women make about harassment and how compliance programs should handle them. But before we get to that, I did just want to say one point. You know, you brought up the ease of documentation, the video documentation that we see with social justice protests and Black Lives Matter. The sort of abstract, bigger dynamic that's working here that compliance officers need to appreciate is that social media has wrestled away the monopoly that companies had on documentation. You know, what happened when she said this and he said that? You had an investigation, there was a report, and the report was the documentation. And now, thanks to social media, no, it's not, because a woman can take all of the gross messages that somebody texted her at 1 a.m, or women could compile their own list of salary figures into a spreadsheet. You can shotgun all of that across social media, and now the company is responding to that. And the documentation monopoly that you would have had 30 years ago doesn't happen. Very much the same with Black Lives Matter and social justice protests. It's just that there's video documentation as opposed to screen grabs or something. But understand what has happened here is that you've lost the ability to keep a grip on the documentation and the official record. Now there's dueling records and companies have to respond to it. But Lisa, you had asked about, you know, allegations and how compliance officers might think about this. So this has been on my mind after a fascinating tale that a compliance officer told me once. She was head of compliance at a large financial services firm, and they had been auditing their hotline complaints and found higher rates of unsubstantiated reports when the complaints were filed by women. So, why? Theoretically, you could wonder whether women file false complaints more often, except that makes no sense in the real world. So this firm was doing a more nuanced analysis, like, where is this discrepancy coming from? And not only that, but, you know, they got to, what are the complaints women are actually making? And do we have the right tools to investigate those issues? And that's where, you know, what is the one complaint women are much more likely to make than men? Sexual harassment. And the firm realized eventually that its investigation protocols and training, you know, they weren't really sufficiently strong enough or suited to handle something as personal and sensitive as sexual harassment. Hence, they wind up with this discrepancy between male and female complaints. So I don't know what all the results of that analysis and conclusion were, or what reforms they made, but I think the point is important that you need to meet your employees where they are and devise compliance tools and practices to help them with the issues that they have, not vice versa, where they have to fit their world into your program. It's just a great way to get employees to view compliance as an obstacle to evade, if that's your approach. And we have enough of that already. You really need to be thinking about, what are their problems? How do we help to investigate and solve those problems effectively? Not, here's our processes, fit your problem into my process. And so that tale the woman had told me about the differences between substantiation rates, it's always struck me as just a fascinating example of how to try and get ahead of these issues and what the compliance program should be doing with it.
Yeah, it's also a thought about, you know, is there potential implicit bias? You know, are there investigators that, you know, are sensitive? Is there a lot? There's just so much to that. But I always found that story absolutely fascinating as well.
Yeah.
And given, you know, the events of the past summer and COVID, and talk about that a little more in a minute, but do you think that discrimination and harassment rates will increase or have increased over the past, you know, 6 months or so?
I mean, will complaints increase? I think yes. My question is more, will they increase in relative terms? Like if you take the Me Too movement, which is now several years old, if you take that as an example, so what happened there? And these are stats that I had pulled from NavX Global's whistleblower benchmarking report, comes out every year. And so in 2019, that was, or with that report for 2019 statistics came out earlier this spring. That was the first time we'd seen a decline in the percentage of total complaints devoted to harassment. And that was about 2 years after noticeable increases, thanks to the Me Too movement, which I believe emerged at late 2017. But the absolute number of complaints about harassment, that did actually go up in 2019. So what happened was just employees are complaining about so many things that the pie is growing even larger than that specific slice of sexual harassment complaints. My question, which we can't answer yet, and we won't for another several years, will we see something similar happen with racial discrimination and social justice complaints? I suspect the answer is yes, that we're going to see a big spike in those kind of complaints happening in 2020 and possibly in 2021. After that, maybe we'd see a relative decline if complaints about many other things are still rising as well. I also think that we should remember that complaints about racial discrimination do not happen solely via the hotline. Accusations that arrive, say, by social media, I think those are likely to keep proliferating. And that's probably the more painful way to realize you have a racial problem is not when people are complaining internally, but when they shotgun a video or onto Twitter. So there's a certain thing that, like, it's incumbent on companies to try and keep all of these issues. I don't want to say keep them in-house because that implies a layer of secrecy. That's not what I mean. But you really want to make sure that your corporate culture is not threatening and inviting enough that when minority employees feel like there's some sort of racial equity issue, that they feel comfortable bringing it up to their boss or to the hotline, not going out in a blaze of glory where I quit, and by the way, here's my Twitter feed, bang, and they shoot a video for millions of people to see. That's not what you want. But if your corporate culture is flawed, that's what you're going to get. So I'll be very curious to see how all of these dynamics play out. But you know, your first question there, are we going to see more complaints about this? I can't imagine a scenario where we won't. But that's what I think about the issue.
Right. I mean, when I think about it, it's similar to what you're saying. I also think when you get to the point, or one would be at a point where they are going out and using social media, that, as you said, it's a failure within an organization. It's also a failure for the organization if it's truly not an aberration and people start coming out and talking about it more and more. That's why not only the culture, but the reporting, and the day-to-day interactions, and you know, the growth is in appropriate ways. It's just so important right now. I mean, looking at diversity and balance and growing organizations to listen to different viewpoints is, I think, one of the things that's come out that's positive from some of this, with a lot of other negative. You know, I think the flip side of some of that too is this feeling of retaliation for raising concerns or other things. But I think, you know, with COVID, you know, and in a traditional model, women may be more responsible for home or family, and that's changed a lot over the years. But during COVID, suddenly with families at home, regardless of, you know, any different configuration, there are people out there who are feeling that because of issues related to childcare, being educators, caring for family members, they may not feel they're being treated fairly if they're as available as others, and that hits women. And another point that I was speaking about with somebody over the weekend, a woman I hadn't seen in a while, was talking about how much more she was working because she wants to help out. She doesn't have children, but one of her colleagues and a drug manager have kids under the age of 6. So at the one time, you know, on the other hand, this isn't a retaliation point, but you really want to be helpful. But on the other hand, then there start to be questions about, you know, allocation of work or things like that. And then with job loss, you know, people losing jobs may say it's retaliation. I mean, where do you think retaliation is these days?
Well, It's very difficult to say because there's so much volatility in work routines right now that I don't think we have any easy answers to. It would be one thing if, for example, if we knew for a fact that a vaccine was 10 years away and how we are working right now is going to have to become a long-term permanent thing. I do think that there are a lot of companies that would change their personnel practices, their HR practices, their policies and whatnot. And maybe society would change, hopefully in beneficial ways, to think about things like gender equity and who takes care of the children and so forth. But that's probably not what's going to happen. We probably are going to have a vaccine sometime in the next several months. So we probably are going to get back to some semblance of normal sooner rather than later. Won't be exactly like 2019, but I bet by 2022, it will be more like 2019 than, say, 2020. But that, for a big company, you're thinking then, how many of these changes have to be permanent? And they don't know. Some of them should be permanent anyways. Some changes should be transitory. And it's not easy to figure out what we should be doing to have a large, complex workforce. And a lot of people are going to respond to that in very uncertain and very diverse ways. And sure, some people are going to feel like it's retaliation that people with parents with small children get more time off than others. Now, I have small children. I don't think I should get more time off than somebody with no small children. I think everybody should get a little bit more time off, but I don't think I should get twice as much time off as the next person who might not have any children or whose children are grown. I don't know what the right answer is. And I don't have a good answer for that. I think that we're in such a volatile state with how workplaces have to run. It is more difficult to define what retaliation actually is. It's very easy to feel retaliated against. And that is something compliance officers could think about. You know, how would you actually document what is legitimate retaliation versus somebody who is perceiving a slight that it's just, dude, it ain't there. It's not actually anything personal. It's very difficult to unravel that kind of distinction sometimes. And I feel like I don't have many good answers, but I can certainly say that it's going to be a significant problem for a while.
Yeah, I think it will. And I think it will also continue when, to the extent that there are offices to go to again, because, you know, schools maybe at different times or even other things that some people may say, I've been working at home tremendously well. And other people need a third, you know, an extra, a different sort of space. And yeah, Companies may think we don't need to pay for buildings, you know, space anymore. So I think there are a lot of things that are going to come up where there'll be inequalities and how to think about that from a retaliation standpoint.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. There are going to be inequalities that get created. Now, how many of them are an unfortunate fact of life that we'll have to live with for a while? Or what would we do to rectify them? Would a company do it? Should the state do it by passing a law? We don't know. We've got no idea. We're still very much in the infancy of figuring out how to live with the pandemic. Not that early phase in March, April, and May, where we're just figuring out how do we make sure the lights still stay on. That's behind us. But this intermediate phase, this is going to be very difficult.
And a challenge for compliance officers, which is one other topic that I know that, you know, something that you write about regularly, and you'll get, usually after you speak about this, you'll get a lot of people sending you confidential messages or calling you, which is about retaliation against compliance officers if she feels as if she's going to raise something. And after that, you know, suddenly the person who's supposed to be raising these concerns is suffering from retaliation or leaving the organization. And on Radical Compliance, for those of you, radicalcompliance.com, there have been, you know, tales from different compliance officers with some stories that you just can't believe. It's like, are they real, or, you know, is this a law school exam or a movie?
Yeah. I mean, for better or worse, the tales of retaliation against compliance officers, that little series I run from time to time, has long preceded the coronavirus, which is probably makes it even more sad, lamentable fact. But I I encounter a lot of compliance and audit professionals who say that that really is something that they have either experienced or that they worry about. There is a study from a few years ago that the Institute of Internal Auditors did, looking at how many auditors have felt pressure to change the conclusions they reached in an audit. And the number was more than half said that they had been leaned on by senior executives to hush up an awkward finding in an audit report. Compliance officers, the ones that strike me the most are when their board and their CEOs express some sort of retaliation against them. And like, I don't know what to do about that. There's no internal control or policy you can adopt to say that, a jerk CEO or an unsupportive board that's hanging you out to dry, that they can't do it. It's easy to say, well, you have to have some integrity and walk. It's a lot harder to do if unemployment is in double digits, or, your spouse is unemployed, or you don't have a spouse and you've got kids who need food on the table, or any other number of things like that. So I don't have any good response to it, but goddamn, man, you still see that day, quarter in, quarter out. I'll get a story from a compliance officer who's facing some sort of retaliation just for doing their job.
It's scary. One of my mentors said to me once, one of the things you always have to remember is to be prepared to walk away. And as a compliance officer, and that's a strange thing to think about your job is, is not related to satisfaction, not related to the, certain, job objectives or other things. But if you feel like you can't agree with something, you have to be ready to leave from the first day you're there thinking about your exit. So, I mean, I don't know if there are any other points you want to raise about that.
I don't mean to be too glib and flip here, but I would always recommend to everybody get fired once in your career and then have a take this job and shove it moment once in your career. Probably not more than once for either of those things, and probably before your age at 30. But, I am no stranger to having been forced out of a job. So I can certainly sympathize with those people who are in difficult predicaments. I don't know. It sounds cliche to say be prepared to walk out, because it's much harder to actually do it. But I've had to do that at once or twice, and I always felt better afterwards. I always said, well, Christ, I should have done that months earlier.
Well, I think with that in mind, I mean, I certainly hope you don't, start a, mass exodus from particular organizations. But if it is, we have a much larger concern coming out of the podcast today. But I do want to say, really how much I appreciate your time. And for anybody who doesn't keep up on the news, Matt does bring us a lot of different scoops and has been also the advocate for many through radicalscompliance.com. And we don't obviously have a ton of male guests on the Great Women in Compliance podcast, but I'm so thrilled that we were able to have you come and speak today and for the support that you've provided to this whole podcast in the community. So thanks so much, Matt, and have a good rest of the day.
All right. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Great Women in Compliance. We hope you'll join us in honoring the great women in the compliance field by subscribing to this podcast and leaving a review.